It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court is taking up a gerrymandering case that could have a wider impact on election law around the country. A law professor tells us what it could mean for elections in the future. First, if you're like a lot of people, you might be reevaluating your life, thinking about where you find meaning and how you spend your time. The Pew Research Center took a look at two surveys where they asked Americans where they find meaning in life. The surveys were 4 years apart, one in 2017, the other in 2021. They found some big, sometimes puzzling, changes. For example, people say they place less importance on their jobs. They're looking instead to the society around them, for better or worse. One of the biggest drops, fewer people said their spouse or romantic partner was a key source of meaning in their lives. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. One, do you think about this? Do you think about where you go to find meaning in your life? If so, what is it? What gives your life meaning? Is it family, faith, job, recreational activities? I don't know. You tell us. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew Taggart is a practical philosopher and meditation teacher. He grew up in Platteville, finished his PhD at UW-Madison. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
So wonderful to be here, Rob. Thank you very much for having me.
The good news is we're not sorting out the meaning of life, but talking about how we find meaning in our lives. First of all, Andrew, why is it worthwhile for us to think about that, to think about what gives our lives meaning?
Meaning is probably the most basic question we can ask, and all of us ask this question at one point or another. Anytime a hardship arises, anytime we wonder about our relationships, anytime we're not sure about the way our life is heading, we're invariably asking the question about what it is that makes our life meaningful. You can't not ask this question at one point or another, it seems to me.
What kind of things do you find as the most common answers to that? Where do you see people going, either from the realm of philosophy or in their daily lives, that helps people find that meaning?
Yeah, let me begin very philosophically with a provisional definition so as to ground our discussion.
Sure.
So let me say that meaning, provisionally understood, refers to being in touch or in contact with some greater reality. I'm leaving off filling in what that greater reality is, but that will allow us to account for people who believe that being engaged in certain political causes is meaningful, or those who are involved in ecological matters, or indeed those who are involved in their faith. So what we're trying to do there is to ascertain whether or not someone actually is in contact with some greater reality. So I tend to find that, since I speak with a kind of subset of the population, that people are really turning quite incredibly right now toward religion and spirituality. But these are not the only answers they would give.
Now, this Pew study I mentioned, I don't know quite what to make of it. One thing that they didn't ask about is faith and spirituality. I think it's kind of rolled into a general social meaning kind of question. But what was interesting, it was kind of a pre-pandemic and in the midst of the pandemic survey. And one big drop was in, you know, people seeking satisfaction or meaning in their jobs, in their work lives. Does that strike you as surprising at all?
You're feeding me this question. We've talked about work in relation to meaning before, I think, some years ago. So no, it doesn't really strike me as surprising. I thought what was surprising, like you, though, is that many of the metrics they used or the categories used all suggest that people were down on it. They were down on society being a source of meaning, down on spouses and romantic partners being a source, down on finances and jobs, and down on physical and mental health, at least in the case of those who are older. So I think what we're starting to see here, and we can loop back in a moment to jobs, if you like, is a great sense of confusion that's coming over people, a great sense of perhaps being a bit lost when it comes to these matters. As a philosopher, I tend to think this is actually a blessing, a good thing, because it's confusion that helps us to actually reconsider, reevaluate the question so as to ask the question afresh. Wait, if it's not the case that, say, jobs are going to be the source of meaning in my life, then what will be? It opens up a space for genuine inquiry, I would say.
On the practical side of your practical philosophering, if someone is feeling that sense of, you know, maybe rudderlessness or the things that they thought were important not feeling so important anymore, What kind of questions can we start asking ourselves in that situation to chart maybe a new path?
So the first thing we can do there is to say something like, well, have we understood that, well, let's take jobs. I once thought someone might say that having an important career is going to be the basis for my life. And now I've come to realize that it is not. So what the person needs to start asking is, if that's not the case, then what could it be? And usually the person will go on to the next common category. It'll be relationships, as you just saw. So you might ask, well, what about relationships can make my life meaningful? And the person can start digging in there. But what if it's the case that someone has doubts about that? Then we'll start to see what looks like in the East called neti neti, which is an approach called not this, not this. It's not pleasant. In the West, we call it the way of negation. But that starts to generate a real keen interest in continuing to deepen the inquiry. And what you'll find is that if you do so with enough earnestness, that the answer will come. Now, the answer may be surprising to you. It might not be available to you at the outset, but the answer will arise.
We're talking to Andrew Taggart, a practical philosopher. You can follow him online. He blogs as The Practical Philosopher. We are talking about finding meaning in our lives. And we want to know, what does that mean to you? You could join in at 800-642-1234. When you look around at the different parts of your lives, a career, a family, faith, involvement in maybe a political or ecological or other issue, what is it? What is it that you feel like gives your life meaning or direction? Or are you still trying to figure that out? If so, you are certainly not alone. You can join in with your thoughts, your reflections, maybe your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew, getting back to that Pew study, one thing that was kind of interesting and maybe a little puzzling, more people from 2017 to 21 cited society or institutions or things like that as a source of meaning in their lives, but at the same time saying in kind of a negative way. They were worried about those things and finding, I don't know, them driven away from those kind of institutions. What did you make of that?
Oh, well, there's a longstanding issue when it comes to institutional life in the United States. But I think we can go back really to the onset of modernity and see, most especially, particularly after the German-English Enlightenment, that we have become increasingly skeptical of institutions as being that which is authoritative over our lives. And certainly this got ramped up after Vietnam. So I don't know if this is quite surprising from a broad point of view, from a historical point of view. But if I can speak a little bit more concretely, my intuition would be to say also that people, especially during lockdowns, especially during a time when things have become more digitized, as it were, are actually experiencing a great deal of alienation from others, right? From the sentient, the contact with other beings. And you can say there's a certain kind of smallness of life that many of us have experienced, a kind of insularity. So we look on the outside and see that there is war and Ukraine, that there is inflation. We have a certain abstract sense that society matters, but the capacity to be in touch with other sentient beings, I think, is gone missing. So I would call that kind of following this line of thought alienation. And therefore, I would say people would cite society as being quite important. At the same time, they would say, however, it's had a negative impact on the life that I'm leading.
Bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dan is with us in Stevens Point. Dan, hi.
Hi there. What gives meaning to my life is I'm giving meaning to, which is my work on climate change. I am a volunteer, have been for 10 years with Citizens Climate Lobby here in Wisconsin. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization working to keep this a livable planet. And I can't think of anything more important to do. All of us are going to feel the impact of climate change if we haven't already, and many of us have already. We need to work together, people of all parties, all religions, all backgrounds, to bring this under control for the good of the planet and for the good of all the people on it.
Dan, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that. Andrew, that idea of seeing a problem in the world, getting together with others, and then working to solve a problem. That you were touching on that earlier as a one definite possible path for us to find meaning.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And the caller, Dan, I believe it is, mentioned that what brings it all together is that we wish to live on a livable planet. So if I may come back just for a moment to the understanding of a meaningful life, I would say that Dan, it seems, is living a meaningful life in virtue of having found something basic, something quite real, that pulls many dimensions of his life together and gives it a central organizing function. That, I think, is a characteristic formal feature of what we notice in people who report on having lived meaningful lives.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Andrew Taggart, author and practical philosopher, has a PhD from UW-Madison, talking with Andrew about where and how people find meaning in their lives and how that might have changed over time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you think about or have thought about? Did you change what you thought about the meaning in your life? What led to that change? Is there something that you would point to of the things you do, the people you interact with? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Andrew Taggart, a philosopher, talking about how and why people find meaning in their lives, how that might have changed maybe during the course of the pandemic for some people. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Over the course of the pandemic, did you rethink some big aspect of your life? Did something that used to seem important become less important to you? What filled that gap? What to you gives meaning in your life, your daily life, or the big picture? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew, sometimes reading the work of the big philosophers doesn't feel very practical while you're doing it. Do you have any sources of inspiration you might point toward for people, you know, thinking about this search for meaning in our lives?
Oh, certainly. I think one of the big philosophers here is the one that everyone listening would be familiar with, and that would be Socrates. Socrates was inviting us over and over and over again to ask these basic questions, like what is piety? What is virtue? What is justice? What is a good life? And he also helped us to see that we need to examine these matters very closely. And one of the things that's very interesting about the Socratic life is that he was arguing that the examination of the life is a key feature of meaningfulness. And I found that to be true myself. So if anyone listening finds that he or she or they are starting to turn over these matters and to make better sense of them, then this one is starting to find that meaning itself is already arriving on the scene.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Madison. Jim, hi.
Hey. I taught middle school for 37 years, and I've been substituting post the pandemic, and one of the things that is conflicting for me is that the kids I'm working with seem to not really feel that there's much meaning to their existence. Outside of both technology and you know, they're really struggling with interpersonal relationships with one another. Kind of the rise of bullying, anti-empathy, and I'm just interested in what your guest has to say about that.
Jim, thanks for the call. The younger generation, Jim was working with middle schoolers there, Andrew.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is certainly a modern tradition of thought that goes by the name of philosophy for kids. So not unsurprisingly, this is a really great age in order to begin asking these big questions. So in lieu of assuming that the kids know the answer to the question about what is meaningful, it can be raised directly. If they're open to it, you can ask them things like, is chocolate cake meaningful? Is eating chocolate cake meaningful? Or is finishing a workout, which seems to be fulfilling, the same as being meaningful? That would be an interesting place to begin. And if you could begin to clarify what meaningfulness is, then you can begin to ask about the sorts of things that actually count as meaningful. For one thing, we really notice about people leading meaningful lives is that they have a clear sense of direction. Not that they're myopic or blindsided, but that they seem really focused, that there is something about their lives that gives it a kind of order, a harmony, a clarity. And so it would also be good, as part of the exercise at hand, to begin to point to some of those examples, to find some really wonderful, shining examples of people who ostensibly are leading meaningful lives, for the children to contemplate, to ponder, to see whether that is actually applicable to them.
Jim, hope that gives you some ideas if you go back to substituting in the fall. We're talking to philosopher Andrew Taggart about how we find meaning in our lives. Still time for you to share your answers at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andrew, you were talking about the idea of the examined life and why we should ponder these questions and think about them. I think some people might say, no, my key to happiness is figuring out how to live in the moment and not be burdened with that kind of thinking. Is there something there?
I have a Zen Buddhist background too, so I can understand that reply. I would put the matter this way in order to split the difference between these two camps. If things are really going along swimmingly, if you're gardening, then you're gardening. If you're eating presently, then you're eating presently. If you're with others and you're attending to them, then you're with others and attending to them. This is really Zen speak. We've heard a version of it before. However, there are times in our lives when confusions and bewilderments are really just tossed into the air, when we seem to be spun about. And at those times, Socrates would say, you might wish to examine what exactly is going on. So that's the way I would split the difference. I would say that if things are just carrying on nicely, if you are Wu Wei, as the Taoists would say, you're just flowing along with activities, things are intuitively clear to you, artistically clear to you, then so be it. But at those very moments, when things seem quite unclear, we have this wonderful gift bestowed to us. That is a gift of self-examination, the gift of being able to examine on our own and with others these matters so as to come to some resolution about them.
I want to throw in another state of being that I think probably a lot of people find familiar. It's not that sort of flow where you're present in the moment. It's not that conscious self-examination. It's, let's call it distraction. You're zooming down your social media feed or, you know, mindlessly watching a show after show. I'm not criticizing. I'm talking about me here. Andrew, that doesn't seem to me, when I'm doing it, like a healthy thing. How do I get myself into one of those other modes?
Well, hopefully, since we have a little bit of a Zen spirit at the moment, hopefully you will like a Zen joke. I once went to a teacher not too long ago, in fact, at the beginning of the pandemic, and I asked a question. It was different from that one. And he said, "You just stop it." He had kind of a French English accent, if you can imagine that too. "You just stop it." Which is not entirely off the mark. This is basically the essence of meditation. We actually do have to be alert to or mindful of the ways in which we are wandering, dissipating our energy, losing our sense of what it is that matters to us. We have to be quite vigilant on that score. And then we just come back to what it is that truly does matter. So there's a reorientation that takes place over and over again. If you do that with the right effort often enough, with appropriate effort often enough, you'll find that the level of distractions will diminish, and the capacity to really hone in on, to lock in on, to open yourself up to what is fundamentally meaningful will be clear to you, will be clear to you in your actual experience.
Time for one more quick call with Steve in East Troy. Steve, hi.
Hi. You've been talking about meaning as a kind of a subjective thing that we make. I'd like to talk about it also as an objective thing that we don't make. For example, it comes out of the context of literature, and the meaning of a sentence, whether it makes you feel good or bad, has to do with how it fits in the larger context. Mm-hmm. And doesn't our meaning come not just from our making, but also is given to us or is discovered from the larger context, and it's kind of independent in that sense from how it makes us feel, whether
Steve,
good or bad.
Steve, I gotcha. I have to cut you off. Andrew, a huge question with about 40 seconds to answer it.
Oh, wow. Well, I actually agree with Steve. I was going off of the Pew Research, which was asking about how you find something right, meaningful, fulfilling, or satisfying. But I'm actually in the objective camp. Hence, the definition very briefly was being in contact with something that is some greater reality. So I do think that we need to keep turning toward the objective conditions of life so as to find ourselves at rest in something larger than ourselves.
Steve, thanks for that question. And Andrew, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much for having me back.
Andrew Taggart is a practical philosopher and meditation teacher. He grew up in Platteville, finished his PhD at UW-Madison. We talked about the ways we find meaning in our lives, how it's changing for some people according to surveys, and where to find it. Coming up after the news, a law professor joins us to explain an upcoming U.S. Supreme Court case on gerrymandering that could shift the balance of power in election law. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, animals perceive the world very differently than we humans do. A science writer digs into the wild world of animal senses, including some that we just don't have at all. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to take up a redistricting case out of North Carolina that election law experts say could lead to significant changes in how federal elections are run. The case could provide a ruling on a concept called the independent state legislature theory, which could give state lawmakers more unilateral power to set the rules for federal elections in their states. Republicans arguing the case say it would reflect a more accurate interpretation of the Constitution. Opponents say it could take checks and balances out of a vital part of elected government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard about this upcoming case? What questions do you have about it? Do you want state legislatures? Do you want Wisconsin's state legislature to have more direct power over the way elections for president and Congress and Senate are run? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Robert Yablon is an associate professor at the UW-Madison Law School. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Let's take this a step at a time. What is this case out of North Carolina that the Supreme Court says, yeah, we'll take a look at this later this year?
Well, the case is called Moore versus Harper, and it involves congressional redistricting in North Carolina. The legislature, the state legislature in North Carolina, is controlled by the Republicans. They drew new congressional districts after the 2020 census, and they did it in a way that tried to maximize the advantage of the Republican Party. And the map that they created likely would have handed Republicans 10 of the state's 14 congressional seats. Well, that was challenged. That map was challenged in North Carolina state court as a partisan gerrymander. And the North Carolina Supreme Court held that the map that the Republican legislature in North Carolina drew violated the state's constitution, threw it out. And ultimately, there was a new court-imposed map that was put in place, which was a more even-handed map. The legislature was unhappy about this, and they took the issue to the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing essentially that the state Supreme Court didn't have the power to step in and second guess their line drawing decisions.
And that takes us to this idea of the independent state legislature theory. People use it in a couple different ways, I think, but in a nutshell, what does it mean?
Yeah, well, you know, there are several versions of the theory and a range of different ways that it can be applied. But the basic claim is that the federal constitution empowers state legislatures to set the rules for federal elections unchecked by state constitutions or state courts or other state actors. In other words, that state legislatures are independent of the normal constraints on their authority.
So what would that mean if the U.S. Supreme Court said, yep, that's right, North Carolina lawmakers, you are the lone wolf on this one? What would that mean for election laws around the country?
Well, what it would mean for redistricting in particular is that the state legislature has the last word. And so if a legislature like the one in North Carolina decided that it wanted to engage in an aggressive partisan gerrymander, there would be no other state institution to stop it. And it could have wider implications than that. It could mean, for example, that those states that have shifted redistricting authority away from state legislatures and tried to give it to independent commissions, they could be thwarted because the court might say that the power has to stay with the legislature and can't be delegated to other actors. And then there are concerns that an endorsement of this theory by the U.S. Supreme Court could mean that other election rules, even beyond redistricting, could be held by the power to make those rules would be held by the state legislature alone, again, without constraints put upon them by state courts and state constitutions. And this has implications potentially for presidential elections. The independent state legislature theory underlied some of the efforts of President Trump and his allies in the 2020 election to try to encourage state legislatures to appoint their own slates of electors.
I've seen some critics of this idea who, you know, they don't like it in general, but they're not as worried about a post-election reversal of an outcome. The idea would be, okay, legislatures with this independent legislature theory could set up the circumstances under which votes are made and counted and tabulated and things like that, but they couldn't go back and alter the results afterward, which was what a lot of in the Trump camp were hoping to do to overturn the popular vote outcome in states. Do you worry that that line isn't as clear as some people are saying?
Right. Well, so, you know, the efforts in 2020 obviously didn't work out, but there are indications that, you know, there may be future efforts to try a similar scheme. Now, there are other federal laws that may limit the authority of the legislature after the fact to say, even though the voters voted for one candidate, we want to now step in and adopt a slate of electors in favor of the other candidate. But, you know, we would be in uncharted territory. And in the endorsement of the state independent state legislature theory would at least give a little bit of ammunition to those who would you know, attempt that, you know, that strategy.
Talking to Rob Yablon from UW-Madison Law School about a U.S. Supreme Court case, not one of this bundle of rulings they just issued, but one that they said they're going to take up later this year, saying that state legislatures should have more authority over federal elections, basically exclusive authority over federal elections for Congress, for president in their states. Forget the state Supreme Court or state constitutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that idea? What questions do you have for our guest? 800-642-1234 is the number to call or email ideas@WPR.org. Rob, I want to look at some of the legalese here behind this. The word legislature does feature prominently here in the, I think, in the constitutional setup for how these elections work, but it seems like pretty consistently people have read that to mean not just like in Wisconsin, the Assembly and State Senate, but the legislative process, which would include a governor and the court system and the Constitution. Has that been read generally that second way more than that first way over history?
Historically, that has been the predominant reading for sure. Now, you know, so if you want to get to the constitutional text, you're exactly right. It does refer to the legislature. And it's really that one word that is the hook that the proponents of this theory rely on. Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution says that the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. And the proponents of this theory argue that that really means the institution of the legislature and maybe that institution alone. But historically, really, for the past 200 years or more, the consensus has been that that really refers to the legislative power, the power to legislate. And in every state, the legislature itself is a creature of a state constitution. There are limits on legislative authority that comes from state constitutions. Legislatures usually cannot act without the approval of a governor. And even more recently, the U.S. Supreme Court has indicated that legislatures, that the legislative power can rest with the people. And so sometimes in some states, there are ballot initiatives and referenda that are passed by the people. And the Supreme Court has accepted that that is part of the legislative power. And so this really would be a major shift from long established practice.
Right. You mentioned citizen bodies that are empowered to do this in some states. There was a Supreme Court case, I think, coming out of Arizona about 7 years ago, where there was one of these initiatives that took away the redistricting power from the legislature. Legislature challenged that, says, nope, you can't do that. Independent legislature. The Supreme Court said, yeah, you can do that. So we've got this precedent in place, but we've got a different court now. How do you see that playing out?
So you're absolutely right about that. So that case was Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission versus Arizona Legislature, where the court rejected a version of the independent state legislature doctrine. Now, that was a 5-4 decision. And two of the justices in the majority there are no longer on the court. Actually, now three, that Justice Breyer has left. But that majority included Justice Anthony Kennedy. It included Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They've been replaced by justices who have a different view of the world in many cases. And so I think that, you know, a lot of those who follow these issues wonder if those justices will be very respectful of this precedent, even though it is quite recent.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Milwaukee. Susan, hi.
Hi. I am very concerned that the Supreme Court, under its current makeup, is going to take this bill on, because we have a strong majority, basically, that have come out of the recommendations of the Federalist Society, which claims to be conservative, but is actually less conservative than it is supporting of major corporations. And although I think Roe versus Wade is a red herring put out, you know, to distract us all, if you look at the rulings of the conservative justices, they have been overwhelmingly in favor of corporations over the rights of citizens. And what this would do is give state legislatures rights that I think are highly disproportionate, very much fly in the face of the Constitution. The Constitution set up a system of government that very carefully employs checks and balances. By giving the votes in a state to the state legislature that is not answerable to the state constitution, this flies absolutely in the face of checks and balances.
Susan, I gotcha. Rob, what do you think? Would this be, in effect, at a state level, an unchecked, unbalanced power?
You know, that is one of the main concerns with this doctrine. It does mean that the legislature, again, depending on how strong a form of this theory would be adopted, you know, in its strong form, the power to set the rules for federal elections would be left to the state legislature alone. The legislatures in many states are legislatures that themselves have been gerrymandered into power. And normally we do think of those legislatures acting in a broader institutional environment where they can't pass a law without getting approval from a governor. They can't pass a law if it appears to contravene their own state constitution. And so, you know, those checks, those protections are stripped away under the independent state legislature theory.
Susan, thanks for that call. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court taking up a major election law case with UW-Madison law professor Rob Yablon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much power should a state legislature have over the circumstances of federal elections in a state? Elections for president, for Congress, for the U.S. Senate. Do you want to see the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, give state lawmakers more of that power? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk now with UW-Madison Law Professor Rob Yablon. He's with us for a look at the independent state legislature theory and a U.S. Supreme Court case that could change election law in states around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this independent state legislature idea? Should the state legislature in a state be the only body that sets laws for elections for Congress and the presidency? Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry it could make gerrymandering worse? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Elise is with us in Ashland. Elise, hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Oh, very good. Well, this is I've got a question just for the professor, and I suppose it's kind of a big one, but it's you were talking about the admittedly uncertain prospect that if the court does go this way, that state legislatures would be able to appoint presidential electors directly. And, so on the one hand, I think we're all fairly familiar with the Electoral College now and how it distorts the vote. But I think, we're pretty used to being able to, if we can't vote for the president, at least we have the right to elect our state's electors. But of course, it wasn't always that way, back in the antebellum years, and I don't know if it continued after the war, quite a few states had the legislature choose the electors. And, that just, as a citizen, that sounds completely alien to what we think of in our democracy. As I was just asking the professor to speculate on just what does that mean for our
I gotcha. Ideas? Elise, thanks a lot for the call. Rob, the idea that a state legislature could say, yeah, we won't do the popular vote thing anymore. We'll go to the state lawmakers will vote and determine the electors themselves. Is that possibly something that could happen under this theory?
It is conceivable. So the caller is right that in the early history of our country, we did have state legislatures that chose presidential electors themselves. That practice largely died out by the 1820s. And from that point on, presidential electors have been chosen by voters. And if the independent state legislature theory were decisively rejected, I think it would be quite clear that the legislature would not have the power after the fact to try to choose its own electors when the voters, by law enacted by the state legislatures themselves usually, have chosen a particular presidential candidate. On the other hand, if the independent state legislature theory is endorsed, it at least does leave the door open to arguments that legislatures retain that power to step in after the fact if they don't like the results of the popular vote and choose their own slate of electors. Are there other potential limits on that? Yes, but it would at least mean that we would likely see more of those arguments and potentially more of those attempts.
Thanks for that call. We got an email from Matt in Madison who writes, putting the massively gerrymandered Wisconsin legislature in charge of elections is tantamount to putting the fox in charge of the hen house. Matt goes on, Republicans have proven over and over again that their goal is to win in any manner they can. They've attacked the very foundations of democracy and literally faced zero consequences. Can you talk about how, Rob, here in Wisconsin, this independent state legislature theory, if again ratified or confirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court, could play out here in the state?
Sure. Again, it could have a number of implications. In the districting context, it would mean that in the future, people would not have opportunities to make arguments to the state Supreme Court that the legislature overstepped, whether by engaging in partisan gerrymandering for congressional districts or by violating other state constitutional provisions when it drew its congressional lines. Beyond redistricting, it might mean that there would be more difficulties for election administration, because if it really is only the legislature's prerogative to set the rules for elections, then it wouldn't be clear to what extent we could rely on some of the other institutional actors that traditionally have played a very big role in administering elections. So sometimes what the law is underspecified, and we need the Elections Commission, we need local clerks to actually step in and make some of the decisions that help elections operate. And under the independent state legislature theory, it's not clear how much leeway those actors would have any longer to do their jobs. And then beyond that, there is the possibility, as we've talked about before, that a Republican-controlled legislature might feel emboldened to try to appoint its own slate of electors, even if that went against the popular vote.
Talking to Rob Yablon from UW-Madison's Law School, looking at a U.S. Supreme Court case the court has agreed to hear, saying that state legislatures should have more power, maybe exclusive power within a state, to set the terms of federal elections. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Ken is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Ken, hi.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. A quick question. So in regard to a state legislature basically just picking its own slate of electors for the presidential election, regardless of the way the vote went, is there some requirement that the joint session of Congress or the vice president or the Electoral College itself, if it is an entity, to basically put conditions and say, we will not accept your electors unless they were chosen by method XYZ? And so it would be like kind of like a federal safeguard that would say, you know, if your electors were just picked because, then we're just not going to count their votes. And I know that could lead to a situation where you don't get to 270 electoral votes, but I'm not considering that as part of the question.
Ken, thanks for the call. Interesting question, Rob. If the Supreme Court says the Constitution says state law legislatures get to do this, can Congress say change laws along with the president to say, yeah, you can't do that?
You know, it's a great question to what extent Congress would have some reserved authority to do that. Now, there is already a longstanding federal statute called the Electoral Count Act. It's been on the books since the 19th century. That law came into play a little bit in the 2020 election, and it does set some rules for the circumstances when Congress is supposed to count electoral votes, when there are competing slates of electors, how those slates of electors are supposed to be processed. The law is notoriously unclear. There have been a lot of people advocating for efforts to update and clarify that law, but that is at least a possible check and safeguard, although, again, it would sort of be untested and we wouldn't know exactly how, say, the U.S. Supreme Court would respond in terms of the constitutionality of that kind of a law.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Guy next in Milwaukee. Guy, hello.
Hi. From what I understand, regardless of the Electoral College, if, let's say, a Republican legislator found out that a poll stayed open 3 minutes later than they were supposed to because their clocks weren't synced up properly, and it happened to be in a blue district or a red district, makes no difference, they could just say, we're going to eject that whole district's votes because they didn't follow the rules exactly to the letter. Is that the case?
Guy, thanks for the call. And Rob, I've heard that concern that a state legislature could set up stringent conditions that say, hey, if you violate these policies, X number of votes, or in some one way or another, votes could be excluded, as some people might see unfairly. Is that a concern?
You know, I do think that that would be a concern if, again, it is the legislature that has unilateral power to make these decisions. You know, right now, and for a long time, we've accepted that some of these decisions can be made by local clerks, that they can be made by the Elections Commission, and that courts may play a role. So, for example, you know, there are times in the past where you might have the power that's gone out at a particular polling place, and a court extends the hours of voting. Now, if the independent state legislature theory were enacted, it's not clear that that power would exist anymore. And if the polling place stayed open longer, it's not clear what the implications of that would be. So, you know, one of the concerns about the independent state legislature theory is precisely because it is novel and untested. There really is some potential for it to create uncertainty in our system and, you know, possibly undermine electoral integrity at a time when that's, you know, really not what we need.
Guy, thanks for that call. And Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Good talking to you.
Robert Yablon is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School. He was with us today to talk about a case taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court that could give state legislatures more power over federal elections in their states. Hey, a related issue, the Wisconsin Supreme Court expected to issue a ruling on drop boxes, ballot drop boxes in Wisconsin elections. We are planning to talk about that tomorrow here on Central Time. Meantime, watch WPR.org for news about that. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, some communities around the world and around the country have been experimenting with a universal basic income program, and there are pilot projects here in Wisconsin, too. Find out how they work, what kind of results they've seen so far, and join in with your thoughts and questions. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Here's a great opportunity for you. NASA wants you to volunteer as a storm chaser on Jupiter. Okay, it's not as exciting as it sounds, but it's also way less dangerous than it sounds. NASA announced a new citizen science project last week. They're looking for people to help go through these extensive online images of Jupiter's atmosphere that are pretty cool looking. And if you do this, you look for certain kinds of cloud activity and turbulence. So you can do this from the comfort of your own home, and the name of the project really sells it. You can be a Jovian vortex hunter. You can literally start right now. Just go to the NASA Citizen Science webpage, click the Jovian Vortex Hunter link, and start exploring. It's space news you can use. This is Central Time.